The following episode of Space Castle contains some references to suicide in relation to fictional and disproven urban myths in the video game industry. If you're sensitive or triggered by the subject, we recommend not moving forward, and we hope you listen to previous episodes or join us next week. Thanks very much, and we love you. Welcome back to Space Castle. It's your clubhouse and hours for all things nerdy. My name's DT. Or is it?
My name's Alex, and it definitely is.
And I'm Seth. Just regular dead Seth.
Fitting. Today we're going to be talking about conspiracy theories and urban myths in video games. One of my favorite subjects. I don't know about you guys.
I really indulge in them quite a lot because they feel like conspiracy theories that I'm not going to like. Get convinced to overthrow the government about, you know?
Yeah.
It's a fun chapter in your, like, gaming history book, you know?
So I was listening to Weird Thing About That podcast, a podcast I really enjoy. You can check them out on Good Pods. They actually just recently celebrated their 50th episode and their 1,500th download, so congrats to those guys.
Hey, congrats.
Yeah, their most recent episode was The Weird Thing About Music. They talked about all kinds of weird conspiracy theories and bizarre happenings in the world of music. And they touched very, very briefly on the subject of the Lavender Town theme from Pokemon Red and Blue, which came out in 1996, which was met with quite a bit of controversy in one of the most interesting and creepy and weird gaming urban myths. I thought we might kick things off from that point on and just see where all this weird rabbit holey shit takes us.
Yeah, there's quite a few to talk about, too. And I think that there's a lot to be said about that particular urban myth, the Lavender Town. Definitely not a suicidal song, but...
Or is it?
Well...
So Lavender Town is obviously a location in Pokemon Red and Blue, which came out in 1996. It's a weird town where there's not a whole lot happening. It's the first instance in the franchise in a series where players actually discover and explore the concept of Pokemon actually being able to die. So the whole town and location and that point in the story in general is met with a lot of sort of weird... sort of side-eye glances because the franchise is otherwise very happy and joyful and kind of silly and playful. But yeah, the theme is relatively creepy chiptune. I'm going to play it for you guys. Let's play just a couple of seconds, just enough so we won't get sued or shut down by Nintendo. And let's talk about it. You guys ready? Okay. Now that you guys have killed yourselves, I've got the Space Castle on myself. And we're going to talk about The Last Jedi and how much it fucking sucks. I'm kidding. So yeah, that is the Lavender Town tune. And the rumor, the legend, the urban myth is that children, after hearing this tune while playing the game back in 1996, killed themselves. What's hilarious about this urban legend is something that Seth brought up in the pregame. And it's not the fact that it could have been like an actual sort of believable urban myth in that 6 or 7 kids, like a dozen kids killed themselves or whatever. The number is 3,400.
Yeah, that's too fucking many.
Which is just so fucking overblown and ridiculous that it just blows the whole theory, the whole legend out of the water. But it's still a fun and interesting one. One of the very earliest gaming urban myths, too.
Yeah.
This is back before the internet really kicked off where things could be easily disproven and whatnot. So it became prevalent for quite a while. It was difficult to check like death records and newspaper stories and news stories from across, you know, the ocean and whatnot to see what actually happened. So it stuck around for a while, and it actually spawned millions and millions of creepypastas and net spookies and all kinds of shit like that. So it still hangs around to this day.
The creepypasta was my first introduction to this, so I came to it a little late. But that being said, I absolutely loved this song when I was playing this game as a kid.
Yeah.
Obviously, I didn't kill myself. I really loved this song as a kid. And I also was very, very depressed in high school. So... correlation, not causation, but it is interesting. So maybe there's some truth to this rumor. But on a real note, though, this song is hauntingly lovely. I think it's one of the best songs in the entire game, personally, because it's like it's one of the only ones with like proper emotion there. It's a chiptune, you know, made with, I think it was 8-bit still at the time, 8-bit sound.
Yeah, it was Game Boy.
Yeah. So, you know, not a whole lot of like tonal depth, but like with most things in this game, like, they brought a lot of emotion out with it. And the fact that, like, Lavender Town is, you know, subtly lavender colored, and you deal with ghosts, and, like, there's a real melancholy about the whole place. This song is, like, phenomenal because of that. I think the entire atmosphere gets sold really, really well because of it. I think it's great. I think the whole thing is wonderful.
I think it's more than fair to call Junichi Masuda a genius when it comes to composing video game music. What he achieved with the Pokemon series in general is just amazing. It's fantastic, and it still all holds up to this day.
Fact, for sure.
I'm going to trigger you right now.
Yeah.
It's a poignant part of the game. I would remember being creeped out when I was like 7 playing these games for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's supposed to be, because it's the first time you confront this. Your Pokemon always faint. I remember all the friends would always say, like, oh, they died. My Pokemon died. That's not how it works. Unless you're playing a Nuzlocke, you're going to hang on to that Pokemon. But I remember it being very, like, powerful. When I listen to this music now, I just think that this is like Griffin McElroy's first take at trying to do the Aether Seed theme. It's really good. To me, it's not dour and gloomy and whatever. It's exacerbated by the story, because you're there in Silphco Tower and Team Rocket's just hawking Cubone skulls, which is crazy. And yeah. Marowak is like haunting you. And that's the whole concept behind like the story in game. But I always just thought, like, this is cool and creepy, and I just want to get out of here really quickly, and maybe please can I get a Ghastly and then a Haunter?
Yeah, because that's the only spot in the game where you can get both of those.
And then I don't think you could get a Gengar unless you traded. But anyway.
It reminds me of Pokemon Black. Do you guys remember Pokemon Black? Well, okay, let me rephrase that. Do you remember Pokemon Black before, like, the mid-2010s when they actually made a Pokemon Black version? Pokemon Black was the, like, original creepypasta. It was a supposedly cursed version of Pokemon Red, Green, Blue, Yellow. It was like a, I guess, sort of a development version of Pokemon. It was like a black Game Boy cartridge with just a black label that said Pokemon on it.
Oh, I heard about this.
And it was like one of the original creepypastas. In fact, I think it's the story that like started the creepypasta idea on the internet. Super, super cool. But that it reminds me a lot of that, where like the Lavender Town song was an urban legend, whereas Pokemon Black was just pure creepypasta. It was a fictional idea that happened right at the beginning of the internet. So it took off as like kind of urban legend-y, kind of like just fun.
You could quote unquote get it on eBay and play it.
Yeah.
If you knew the right source. Yeah, I recall this. Yeah.
Somebody had an uncle who worked for Nintendo or some shit. Yeah.
Didn't they go on to make Pokemon Black and White? Am I going
yes.
crazy?
Yeah, okay. No, that, right, but that was right. That was fairly yeah. recently. Honestly, I don't want to get into the story here because there's lots of other ones to talk about right now, but just Google Pokemon Black Creepypasta. It's a really fascinating story about kind of in the same realm as the Lavender Town one, where it's about like a ghost in the shell, basically. It's very interesting and very fun and creepy, hence the creepypasta. It's good.
There was a fan film that was made based on this urban legend that was like really well received.
Yeah.
With the Cubone Marowak thing,
mm-hmm.
Front and center in it.
And that became headcanon.
Yeah. 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 Really powerful. If I remember it correctly, just like a really powerful fan film. But my urban myth, like Pokemon things, were the things I just sunk a ton of time in because I'd heard it from a friend of a friend of a friend.
Like Mew under the bus or...
Yes, Mew under the truck that was off of Cinnabar Island.
Yeah. And
because you do that, you hear that from a friend, and then you also hear from the same friend that you could find Missing No.
Dude, Missing No was my fucking shit. That was when I was like, oh my God, there's secrets in video games?
Yeah, rare candies for days.
Yeah.
Or like the only one that comes to mind that's like so formative was the blowing in the Nintendo cartridge.
Yeah.
And it was the same concept. People say it is a thing, but it was like Nintendo has made statements saying that that's never.
It says it on the back of the cartridge.
Don't blow into this thing. Yeah.
Don't blow into this thing.
Yeah, you get spit and shit all over it. And it's like blowing onto like a camera lens. Like, don't fucking do that shit. Yeah.
It worked for me and I stand by it.
Yeah, because it does work. It clears off dust and all kinds of stuff. Like, it does do things, but it tends to be more trouble than it's worth.
But yeah, I mean, I remember with Missing No, surfing up and down the right side of the island until you could figure, like, and then you had to shut your game off at the right time. And I'm like, this feels like a life hack and not a gaming hack.
It's like the best glitch, man. I think Missing No is what really made me want to get into Halo 2 level glitching. I think there's a direct line of connection there.
For sure. Same. Yeah. But that's the thing is like you hear that and then you hear about Mew under the truck and you spend 3 days worth of gaming time trying to find where this damn Pokemon is that does not exist, is not coded into this game.
Yep, not a thing.
And you didn't have the internet back then. Well, you did, but not in the same way. I'm sure there are other ones. We could talk about Pokemon all day, but give me your next one.
Yeah, there's another one I wanted to talk about, and it's the mysterious and disproven, maybe not disproven, maybe he's actually still out there, Bigfoot, in 2004's Grand Theft Auto San Andreas.
Hmm.
So this one is actually kind of kicked off inadvertently and accidentally by Rockstar themselves, wherein they put in-game references to Bigfoot's possible existence within the game. This led to players all over the world trying to actually find Bigfoot in the northern section of the game map and failing, and many people lying and faking screenshots and trying to say that they actually were able to find Bigfoot. What's fucking hilarious about this one to me is the fact that everybody knows like the real world legend of Bigfoot. We've all seen like the National Enquirer photos where he's blurring out of focus and there's no way to like quote unquote disprove or prove it. What's awesome and fucking great is when people started saying, oh yeah, I found Bigfoot in Grand Theft Auto San Andreas, they also said that they weren't able to get a screenshot because it was just too fast. And when they actually did get a screenshot, oh, it was blurry. Even though there was no fucking blur effects in that game at all,
yeah.
It's just fucking amazing. But it still to this fucking day perpetuates in gaming circles that people actually believe that Bigfoot exists in this game. The most common area of the game that people think they have seen him or claim to have seen him is the Mount Chiliad Natural Arch area outside the city up north. It's actually never been proven. Rockstar themselves have actually come out and said, yeah, no, there's no fucking Bigfoot in the game. People started modding the game and putting like a model of Bigfoot out in the distance and taking screenshots of it. And Rockstar has said, no, guys, there's no fucking Bigfoot in the game. Shut the fuck up. And people still to this day persist and insist that there is Bigfoot in this game. And it's fucking hilarious to me that they just won't let this one go.
It's so prevalent that they put Bigfoot in Grand Theft Auto 5.
Yeah, and they also put Bigfoot in fucking Red Dead Redemption 2.
Yeah.
It's just become one of those fun, like, inside jokes with Rockstar.
I love that shit. That reminds me of, like, a gaming urban legend that I want to talk about.
Please do.
One, we will talk about Polybius, I'm sure, because how can we not?
Oh, we have to.
This urban legend is probably the one that I have spent the most time obsessing over. That's a good way to put it.
How many tabs in your browser are currently open for it, Seth?
Currently, none.
Okay.
At my height, probably dozens.
Damn.
This is an urban legend that not only spawned an entire handful of subreddits, but has changed, I think, game development forever.
Really?
That is the 7th Vault of Glass chest.
Oh, okay.
Anybody who played OG Destiny 1 quite literally just got sweaty palms. 7th chest, man. This is a rumor of a 7th treasure chest in the Vault of Glass raid in Destiny 1. For those who don't play Destiny, you should at least know a little bit about what it was, but it had raids in it, and in these extremely long, extremely hard raids, you would get treasure chests, basically loot chests, along the way. And in Vault of Glass, there were 5, but there was a 6th one that was found and hard to get at and we knew about. But OG Destiny 1 was so unbelievably full of Easter eggs and hidden objects and crazy geometry in the world and all kinds of stuff that it kind of snowballed. And the Vault of Glass was the only raid at the time, but it was frankly fucking massive. There was probably twice the amount of space and geometry in the like raid cavern than was actually used for the raid.
Yeah.
So you could just explore and like find secret tunnels and
classic Bungie, man. Like
dude, there's so much, and there was references all throughout the lore of like all the stuff. Like it was a deep web. So deep that it spawned the subreddit r/raid secrets. But also that got so big and so intense. Like it has like currently, it has 308,000 members, that one subreddit. It was so deep and hardcore that Raid Secrets has become parts of other games now. There is raid secrets for other games. And the reason I say it has changed game development is because this idea of like a super unbelievably deep Easter egg with like ARGs, multiple ARGs, and like binary secrets, and just if you can think of like a way to hide something in a video game, our raid secrets has explored that within the Vault of Glass. Like it, they tried everything, and I was deeply into this as well. It became such a phenomenon that other games have started following suit and putting super deep Easter eggs and super hard to find like loot and all kinds of stuff hidden throughout their raids and stuff too. So like this has become like a thing.
Do you remember what broke it for you though? Like we were just talking, like Destiny expanded on that more than any other game that I've seen. Bungie took what they did with Halo and they were like, okay, people really liked getting out of the map, doing kind of these fun things. Then they legitimized it in Destiny by making it a legit thing. You know, and we see this in Ready Player One with the adventure Easter egg. Like, what was it that broke it for you? Because for me, it was Halo 2, the butterfly and the rocket glitch.
Yeah.
Halo 2 is a game that was like very much built on how they broke it. Mm-hmm. So like the pro scene was you had to know how to quad shot. You had to know how to BXR in order to be effective. If you couldn't do that, you couldn't compete. And those same things were used casually, though, in custom games to get outside maps and to literally float your way to places that developers had made for funsies because they just, I guess, had extra time or just found out, like, if I piece these parts of the map together, then people could go and kind of play around and jump around and find new cool places. That's legitimized in Destiny. But to circle back, do you remember what it was that, like, oh, here's the thing that I found that broke me, and now I'm going to be looking for this stuff in every game if I even hear a hint of a legend or a myth about something in the background?
That is not a singular point for me.
It is for me.
In this particular instance, this is such a snowball effect. I think what really does it for me is in the Vault of Glass, there's too many legitimate hidden shit, secret passageways or sequences to do certain things. In one of the sections, you have to like stand in beacons and defend them from waves of enemies before that the next phase starts of the raid. And if you did that in a certain order, it actually did a thing and actually changed how the raid played out or which chest was available as you like went down a secret passage. There's too much of that in this raid where like if someone was just like, yeah, I heard if you fucking kill this boss in this way or with this gun, it would change the loot table in the chest and you could finally get this really cool secret gun. The problem with that, normally in video games, you're like, uh-huh, yeah, sure, dude. Well, I'll stay out of the random lobbies from now on. Like, we're not going to spend 7 hours trying to do it this certain way. Like, it's fine. The problem was that was actually true in Vault of Glass. It was real. If you pull out your sniper and you look off through the game fog at the back wall of this cavern that we're in, that you shouldn't be able to get to, but if you spend 6 hours and you jump all along this geometry and you glitch out of the map here and you glitch back in over here and then you jump over there and you land on this beacon that is just what appears to be leftover geometry in the level way off in the distance that you can't even see normally. If you jump on there, then it will spawn a secret boss and you can kill it and there's a seventh chest.
Your extra chest.
Yeah. The problem with that is if you did all of that and you got out of the level and you spent hours and hours and you got over there, it would legit spawn another boss for no fucking reason that you could kill. We don't know if it would spawn another chest. Nobody ever found one.
And you're already spending your whole day doing the raid.
You're spending all day in the raid. And the steps that you took to get the seventh chest were real. Actually a thing. It completely snowballed. We're like, the raid secrets community quite literally knows every polygon of the Vault of Glass from Destiny 1. Like every geometry place, every like code, all of the back walls. Like we know everything about that raid because we have searched for years, literally, to find the seventh chest. And another thing was Bungie never really said that it wasn't there.
Oh, those assholes.
Yeah, they want people playing the game. I mean,
there was a lot of devs that were like, we do like to do things in sevens. I, to this day, believe that there is a seventh chest hidden in the Vault of Glass, and we just haven't figured out the sequence to unlock it.
It haunts you, doesn't it?
It does. And I will occasionally pop back in. It is so prevalent and so solid that, like I said, there is still 308,000 people in this subreddit looking for the seventh chest.
It's fucking crazy.
Yeah, and every raid since then has incorporated shit like that for Destiny. There's been dozens of raids now, or I guess like a dozen raids. Everyone since then has incorporated super secret, super hard to do, random bullshit, Easter egg sort of shit to find other chests. It's a thing. And that's what's so frustrating about the seventh chest, man. Because, like, maybe it is actually there. Like, no, yeah. It's really, really spiking my secret finding, like, conspiracy theory brain right now. Just talking about it again after all these years.
The dopamine, like, need is there. You're like,
Every so often, there's a new thread that's like, seventh vault of glass chest found. Finally, here's a YouTube link that I did it. It's not like a Rickroll. We've moved past that, but it is like, you know, some bullshit. It's like, I see a glint of a thing off in the distance. Like, I don't think that's actually a seventh chest, but it pops up and I get excited like every so often when a new thread comes out. Like, maybe we finally fucking did it, dude. I don't know.
Maybe someday. I believe in you, Seth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of sevens, and getting back to Alex's question about that one gaming myth that broke you and sent you down the lifelong rabbit hole of gaming urban legends, mine is absolutely the resurrection of Aeris Gainsborough in Final Fantasy VII from 1997.
Ooh, that's a good one.
So Aeris is one of the main characters. She dies early on in the storyline. She sacrifices herself for the greater good of the party so they can go on and defeat Sephiroth, the main villain, and save the world, blah, blah, blah. Ever since she died, gamers across the world have obsessed about whether or not it was ever possible to resurrect her and bring her back. It's not. I'm just going to say that outright, because obviously the story was written with her having died as a main key plot point. It would be absolutely fucking ridiculous if they essentially wrote two entirely separate games, because that game was absolutely goddamn gigantic, even for the time. It's massive.
Mm-hmm.
But still to this day, there are circles of the internet that discuss and dissect and try and figure out whether or not there was ever an option to resurrect Aeris, or if she was always meant to die, or if there's an entirely separate storyline that branches off from being able to resurrect her. People have speculated, they've lied, they've come up with stories, they've come up with plausible theories that never came to fruition. One of my favorites is there's a materia that you can find in the game called the Underwater Materia, and materia is the magical orbs that are distillations of the planet's life force. They take the form of different elemental and metaphysical properties like healing or fire and so forth. There's one materia that has one purpose in the entire fucking game, and it's the underwater materia that allows you to take the timer off the screen for a very prominent optional boss fight with Emerald Weapon, which takes place in the ocean. There's a timer because you can drown. You can die if you don't defeat it in time. The underwater materia allows you to bypass that. People insisted that because Aeris was basically buried at sea, she was dropped into a lake in her ancient people's town, that the underwater materia had to have been tied to her. You're supposed to be able to max out the underwater materia through dozens and dozens of hours of gameplay, go back to where she was buried underwater and like be able to resurrect her with that materia. It's not fucking true. The game is like almost like 30 fucking years old, and people still insist to this day that there's got to be some way to resurrect Aeris. I hope that with the advent of Final Fantasy VII Remake, I hope that they fuck with people so hard with that fucking theory, and I hope it spawns a whole new generation of people thinking they can resurrect Aeris, because it's been such a long-standing and such a fun urban legend. It's been debunked. Square has said, yeah, no. But then people have gone back and they've used game genies and they've used cheat codes and they've cracked the game and they've created their own fake screenshots of Aeris back in her church where you first meet her as a ghost who follows you around for the rest of the game and all kinds of stupid fucking shit. Like, people were just absolutely obsessed. But yeah, that was the one that broke me. That was the one was like, I was talking with my buddies at the lunch table in junior high about like, do you think you can actually really do it? Oh yeah, no, my cousin totally did it. What? Really? Are you serious? Like, yeah.
Yeah, dude, let's go.
Those discussions still fucking happen on the internet to this day, and I love it. It's wonderful.
That's like some of my favorite parts of gaming.
Yeah, gaming has become its own language. You're so much taking part in the story itself by interacting with it in a way you can't with any other media, that you really desperately want there to be more story when they really physically can't be.
Yeah. You get invested. Yeah.
Yeah, you get invested. And it's, I think that's why MMOs took off, is because you can kind of write your own story. At the end of the day, when there's something that's so like loved and shared by so many people, I think it's cool that you know, we desperately want there to be more story there.
Yeah.
Yeah. The time spent is so incredible to me. I get so invested in that kind of like secret hunting. I'm about to maybe hurt myself a little bit.
Are you going to listen to Lavender Town again?
No. I'll listen to that after the episode. There's a website.
It's just going to be you and me, Alex, on Space Castle going forward. Seth is checking out.
We'll have the ghost of Seth.
Yeah, I'm out of here, guys. I got to go find the seventh chest. There's a website called wastedondestiny.com. And what it does is show you how many hours you have played in Destiny. The reason that this is so big and happened with this community is because spending thousands of hours inside of a raid trying to figure out where the seventh fucking chest is. So we wanted to know how long we've wasted in Destiny. If I pull up my numbers real fast, it's a little harrowing to see them on screen. I have 2,387 hours inside Destiny 1.
The fuck?
Destiny 1 was only out for like 2 years before Destiny 2 came out.
Hold on. I think we've talked about this in an episode before, and I think that number has gone up since then, Seth.
Here's the thing. Remember how I said every so often a seventh Vault of Glass chest thread pops up?
And Seth goes back. This is 100 days.
Seth has got an SMS like notification on his phone anytime a seventh chest notification pops up, and he runs into his living room and vaults over his couch. And
look, all I'm saying is you can set up a Google alert for any phrase. I have easily spent over 1,000 hours inside the Destiny 1 Vault of Glass. At least. Has to be. Dude, if I had a full raid team ever,
You'd have found it already.
If I had a full raid team even back in Destiny 1 days, yeah, we would have found it by now.
One of these days, the story is going to break that somebody found the seventh chest. And it's going to be like Willy Wonka's golden ticket times a fucking million for Seth. It's just going to break him mentally.
Yeah, I'll be out. Destiny's a big fucking deal, man. I got to be real with you. I can literally talk about Destiny as an entire podcast. Let's talk about...
We just about have.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Not at all, man. This is super interesting shit. I love this.
Let's talk about like Polybius or...
So you guys were talking about this in the pregame. I'm completely unfamiliar with Polybius. I've heard the name before and I'm familiar. There's a legend about it, but I don't know.
Polybius is my favorite.
So the only thing that I'm familiar with and that I know about this is that Polybius is some sort of like old school arcade cabinet designed to just make you play over and over and over again. Something like that. Take it away.
All right. So the legend started in 1981 in Portland, Oregon. And the alleged theory, or not theory, but the alleged legend, that's a weird thing to say, is that this arcade cabinet showed up in arcades in Portland, Oregon in 1981, like I said. And it was such an addictive and wild and crazy experience that people were actually forming lines around buildings to play it. And people were getting into fights over it. And the game was supposedly causing like psychosis, hallucinations, rage, everybody lashing out at each other, seizures. People were just absolutely obsessed and they kept going back to the arcade and playing it over and over again. And then suddenly after a few months, every single cabinet disappeared and it was never heard from again, despite the fact that all these, like, apparently lots of people were like lining up to play it and were absolutely obsessed with it. There's also rumors that men in black, like dudes in like black tuxedos, would show up at these arcades and disable the game and collect data from it, quote unquote, and then vanish again.
What?
Yeah, pull all the coins and pull all the high scores.
But nobody has any actual recollection of actually playing this game. Nobody has any recollection of ever actually seeing it in an arcade. And that's actually kind of lent itself to the urban legend, was that everybody like just can't remember actually ever playing it, despite the fact that the urban legend has been so prevalent for so many years now. Yeah, that urban legend is probably one of the earliest ones. It's older than I am.
Yeah.
And it's fucking wild.
It's a plot to a sci-fi novel. Like, it's
hey, yeah. Guess what? It is the plot to a sci-fi novel, actually, called Armada.
Oh, I've read Armada. I mean, but that's based on Last Starfighter. And
I have really excellent news about the movie The Last Starfighter, friend.
Based on this?
Also based on Polybius' rumor. Much more loosely than Armada is, but yes, it was stemmed from the same thing. I love this, dude, because there's something really awesome about government men coming into arcades and pulling high scores and pulling all the coins out of a machine and then those machines just disappearing one day. Like, I love that. It's fucking phenomenal. I don't subscribe to the fact that this was actually real. I do love this urban legend a lot.
So this went so far as to there actually being Freedom of Information Act, like, searches for this fucking game.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, for real. No, like, the FBI, way. The Federal Bureau of Investigation in the United States has actually done research and looked for records of this game ever existing. It came back. It never existed. It never fucking happened. But because it came from the FBI and it came from a Freedom of Information Act research paper, it came back and everybody's like, oh, the government's just trying to cover it up
because they're using it
to brainwash people. So the proof of this game never existing has just sort of lent itself and become part of the legend of this game actually existing.
Oh my goodness.
I'm of the mind that the game never existed. But what's weird is, how did this fucking urban legend come about then? Like, who decided on the name Polybius? Like, how did the entire legend come about if the game never actually existed? Like, who would make this shit up that specifically? It's wild. I love it.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, in the 80s, when you don't have anything to reference, like, internet-wise, and you have maybe some magazines that might reference it, or some really gung-ho arcade owner that's like, I need people in here. So they come up with the concept of some crazy game that is just, people are lining up around the block to play. Of course. I mean, I can see something like that happening easily, but I mean, the specificity of it is what's crazy and how it would spread from place to place.
Yeah. And there are videos of people who claim to have played the game. There's been video of actual, like, physical cabinets of the game that are not actual original 1981 copies of Polybius. Mm-hmm. They are recreations. They're, like, new games that were created to sort of feed the urban myth. There's been videos like Angry Video Game Nerd actually did a video where he, quote unquote, played the game and then he talked about his experience afterwards. There's no fucking way it's the actual original, like, 1981 game if it ever existed, because there's no record of it ever existing. But it's one of the, like, the granddaddy urban myths when it comes to gaming. And it's super, like, prevalent and super fun to talk about, because all these people claim to have, like, remembered seeing it in the arcade and then all of a sudden it vanished, but nobody actually remembers actually playing it. I don't know. It's super fun.
It's such fertile ground for stories. Like, I see why Armada spawned from that.
Yeah. And it's the right era, because it's old enough to where obviously people remember it, but, like, it's not old or new enough to where any of it makes sense that it wouldn't exist. It's not new enough that, like, some dude in his garage could have done it. Coding an arcade cabinet and an arcade game from scratch was not a hobby thing that someone could pull out and just make a one-off game that somebody remembers and that starts this rumor. It was too early for that. But it's also late enough to where we have, like, images, quote, of the start screen of Polybius.
Yeah, allegedly.
Yeah, obviously. And it's late enough to where that's a thing that might have happened. So these images might be somewhat legitimate. But it's early enough to where it's not like, oh, this was just made in Photoshop in 2002.
I was going to say, but you give DT 5 minutes and a pat on the back and he can make a Polybius start screen for you.
Yeah. Like, it's right in the sweet spot where it's, like, far enough ago to where it's plausible, but it's not so recent that, you know, it seems fake or could be easily faked.
Ah, man. I love it. I want to put a Polybius machine that doesn't work in a cabinet in my future arcade that has that classic 80s carpet.
What's also fun is there has since been Polybius video games. They have been made, like, two or three of them, I think.
Just, like, references, yeah.
Yeah, just, like, based on the urban legend, basically. Which I think is really fucking fun and awesome.
So there's actually, like, a company named on the start screen of Polybius, and it's a very nondescript, sort of vaguely German company name called Sinischlocken Inc. That company never existed either. So, you know, the idea is that the government made up a fake company, and it was German. It was in 1981, so nobody could even actually do any sort of research to discover whether or not the company existed. It's such a cleverly, like, crafted urban legend, and it's so much fun to try and bite into it. I think we need a Polybius cabinet for Space Castle VR.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's happening for sure.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah, I'm building that 100,000%.
I just love this story.
It's great, dude.
People dunk on Armada, but, like, I think Ernest Cline really, really did a good job taking something like this kernel and then extrapolating on it to make a really cool concept where kids are being recruited based on their ability to crush it in video games.
Yeah, to like fight an alien war. It's very like Ender's Game meets Last Starfighter.
Yeah.
I think Armada is actually quite good. It's like, for me, not to derail yet again, Armada is like the perfect middle ground where it's like, it is like a mishmash of stories that I know, but it's like right perfectly in the middle where it doesn't feel too much like anything. You know, it feels pretty much like itself, which I really like. It's like, it's a good balance.
Well, and that's why Ready Player One was so successful. It's because it had all these familiar elements, but it's like, all right, I'm going to put them into a configuration that you haven't seen before.
I think that's why people shit on Armada so much. It's because Ready Player One was so good that they're like, oh, Armada's like, all right, but it's not.
It's just a different story type. I mean, Ready Player One is Golden Fleece, clearly.
What?
Golden Fleece story, where you're, it's an artifact that's being found. You know what a golden, the Golden Fleece is? Maltese Falcon. Are you familiar?
The Red Herring?
A MacGuffin.
Thank you. MacGuffin.
Yeah, it's a MacGuffin. You're trying to find a specific thing. I mean, that's Ready Player One. This is a completely different story type. It's I'm going to save the world. You mishmash out of, a fish out of water, like out of the bottle story.
Alex, we should start another podcast talking about story structure.
I can only reference Save the Cat so many times.
It's true. Polybius is my favorite, easily.
Yeah, it's one of the longest standing. It's dope. There was one more subject I wanted to touch on, but I feel like that almost deserves its own episode or maybe like a part two to go along with this episode. And that, of course, is the satanic panic that happened with the 80s regarding Dungeons & Dragons.
Yes.
Yeah.
That whole urban legend thing kind of spun up again because of Stranger Things season 4. It's a fun thing to look back at. Now, it wasn't so much fun back then because people who played Dungeons & Dragons got ostracized and made fun of, and there was the constant fear from parents that if you played Dungeons & Dragons, you were going to kill yourself.
Yeah, it was serious.
We will get into that into a future episode because that's something I really want to talk about because it's super interesting. Somebody who's grown up playing Dungeons & Dragons for more than half my life.
Yeah, we definitely will.
Definitely. There's too much ground to cover there to fit it into this episode, but I'm excited to talk about it.
Let's talk about one more urban myth, and that is the urban myth of Goldblum. Does he actually exist? Or is he just a chiptune like thing that I just throw in at every episode? Is there an actual Goldblum? I don't know.
Well, he listened to the Lavender Town theme, so it's the ghost of Goldblum now.
Oh, Lavender Town. I feel bad that I played that short clip at the beginning of this episode and all of our listeners killed themselves, and now we'd have nobody listening to our podcast anymore. It wasn't great for marketing purposes, let me just say that. So we're going to have to start over from the beginning, start a whole new Twitter account. I'm going to have to get all new listeners and followers. Sorry, guys. I didn't mean to do that. And nobody's going to listen to these messages from Earth.
Join the Dames,
an actual play podcast.
I'm Chrissy.
I'm Maddie.
I'm Lydia.
And I'm Jacob, the guy they roped into running this thing.
As we play a new indie system each season.
With danger.
And plenty of dice and drama.
And jokes.
Are we doing this as our characters?
You don't have to.
You don't have to. You can do whatever
you
want.
But we have character voices this time.
I mean, you can sound like a robot, I guess.
Go again.
Okay.
Welcome to danger. Go again. All right. I don't know what my character voice is.
Welcome to Danger Dames.
All right, ready to segue? I don't know what to do with that now. I don't know what to do with this transition from the messages from Earth into the deep space anymore because I fucked myself so terribly last week with discovering that it's actually pronounced segue.
I thought fucking yourself terribly was the point of calling it seg. That was what you were doing the whole time.
Not terribly. No, expertly and gingerly. Oh, to full completion every time.
You guys just train wrecked into the second part of the podcast here.
Yeah, I'm going to hijack this. Look, I've been out looking at shit, okay? I've been finding cool stuff. If you're on the Discord, you know that I've discovered this one very recently, and I'm all about it. Surprise, it's another YouTube channel. This time it's a channel called Acerola, which is an extremely esoteric and niche channel. However, stick with me because I think it's worth watching even if you don't care about the subject matter. So, it's a channel about making video games. This person, Acerola, is a technical artist, which means that they make tools for making video games and deal with shader instancing and, you know, stuff like that. Technical artists are straight up wizards, even like to people like me.
Seriously. Yeah.
I would say the thesis of the channel so far, it's still fairly new and doesn't have a lot of videos. The thesis of the channel, and I would say fully half the videos so far, are boiled down to this. And that is, your video game grass sucks and I can prove it mathematically. Period. That's the channel. Billboarding and GPU instancing for grasses and animation shaders and stuff like that.
Interesting.
And it's very well thought out, very well laid out. I learned quite a lot as someone who's trying to like build out, you know, these kind of systems. But that is not why I love this channel. I love this channel because Ace Rolla's whole vibe is the thing that I want to adapt into my entire life. Okay, I cannot convey, one, because this is an audio medium and is inherently limited, but also because I don't have the words. English has yet again failed me, because this person's vibe is 11 out of 10. Like, they're just like in what appears to be a living room of some kind, just with a microphone, standing there with like a straight up DGAF attitude and like, look, your shit sucks. I'm going to tell you how to fix it. Let's fucking go.
Love it.
It's phenomenal. But like, I stumbled across one video about grass shading and density in a plane and like how to manage crazy amounts of grass billboards in a game without overloading, like millions and millions of them. Cool. And then video starts and this dude is just fucking chilling, standing there in his living room like, sup, let's fucking talk about grass, let's go.
Yeah, like, I bet this guy likes to talk about grass,
dude. Hey. He has that vibe a little bit, but not like a stoner vibe, but like a yeah I do LSD, it opens my mind to deal with shader algorithms, like what do you want from me. And they do have other videos, not on grass shaders, but it's definitely like video game making centric. So you have to at least deal with a little bit of that if you're going to watch, but it is fucking worth watching just for this dude's vibe. Like, oh my God, I want it in my life. It's great. It's easily the best YouTube channel I've seen all week. And I have watched every one of their videos now, sometimes twice. Man, it's great. The vibe. I keep saying that because the vibe is so good that like it has infected my whole life.
I got to check it out.
Yeah.
Ace Rolla, you said?
Ace Rolla. A-C-E-R-O-L-A. Ace Rolla.
Yeah, I'm going to subscribe right now. This guy sounds dope as shit.
I am not kidding when I say the thesis is your grass sucks and I can prove it mathematically. Because there's a pretty fair bit of math in these videos, and that is the attitude. It's like, fuck off. Let me prove it to you.
There's a trend with Seth's Deep Space picks where it's just people with excellent personalities on there. Like Zach Friedman was one of our early Deep Spaces, and I love those videos now.
I spend so much time on YouTube that like I can find, you know, MIT lectures on shader graphs, sure, but I'm in it for the vibe now. Like, yeah, I want you to to know about these millions of billboards in this scene, sure, and show me the math because I do need to know that, but also like, let's be friends too.
Seth is in the I now appreciate and understand Picasso phase of his art history.
Dude, I do kind of feel like that, actually.
Dope, man. Thanks for sharing, dude. Do we have a listener question? This is going to be the last listener question because everybody's dead now. Who sent in our very last question? And what is that question?
This listener question comes from Roland.
Esquire, you said.
Roland Esquire. Yeah. And I want to modify it a little bit. So the question is, I think is really fun. And that is, if you had one F-bomb to drop anywhere in Avatar The Last Airbender, where would you put it? And I want to modify that a little bit too. You have one F-bomb to put into an IP that does not have an F-bomb. What is the IP and where would you put it?
I like it. Harold, hopefully you're cool with this. Oh, Harold, Jesus.
Roland. Got you.
Hopefully Roland is very cool with this as well. Thank you, Roland, for sending that in via the Gmail account, sbscastlepodcast@gmail.com. What you guys got?
So, Alex, where would you put it?
Oh, I'm going first. I'm going to stick with Roland's initial question. and put it in Avatar: The Last Airbender. I'm going to go end of book one, the sanctuary in the water tribe. There is Commander Zhao and he's about to kill the moon spirit. And Uncle Iroh drops the F-bomb and he says, whatever you do to that spirit, I'll unleash it tenfold. Let it fucking go now. Just to add emphasis.
Damn.
That's pretty good, dude. That's a good F-bomb.
Because it's already got so much power to that one line. And I think about it all the time. And when I do, it gives me chills. Because you actually see Iroh's true colors. Because he's advising Zhao the entire time. And here comes to this point of confrontation where his entire set of values is challenged. We see that Iroh's actually a good dude who cares more about balance and the nature and structure of the world than conquering, which is represented by Zhao. So he's like, fuck you, put the fish down.
Nice. I dig it. I can go next if you want.
All right. Yeah, do it.
Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. It's been two movies now since Legolas and Gimli have been in competition to see who can kill the most enemies. And we get to the Battle of Pelennor Fields, the quintessential and sort of like culmination of the War of the Ring between the forces of Sauron and the free peoples of Middle-earth. And there's a scene where Legolas takes down an entire oliphant, which is a giant, like 30-foot elephant with like a giant platform full of bad guys all over it. He takes it down single-handedly. He's up on the fucking trunk. He's shooting arrows. He's cutting the fucking platform off the back of the oliphant. And he kills the oliphant by shooting three arrows in the back of its skull and takes the whole fucking thing down. He slides off the trunk, lands in the ground, gives Gimli sort of an arrogant sort of look. And Gimli looks back at him and says, fuck you.
That's pretty good.
That still only comes as one. No, that's good. I love that.
It's a pretty good one. That's good. Okay, I'm glad I went last because I may have won this one.
Oh.
Not that it's competition, but I think I have the best one. So I'm also going to stick with Avatar The Last Airbender because I've wanted to put an F-bomb in this forever. And my episode is not as profound as Alex's, but I think it might be better. So this is season 3, episode 17. And for those who are in the know, that is the Ember Island players.
Ember Island. I knew you were going to say Ember Island.
Yeah. And the F-bomb I want to drop is while they're watching this play, everybody's getting increasingly kind of upset about like how they're being portrayed, all of that stuff.
Except Toph.
Except Toph. Well, okay. They're getting increasingly upset. And then Toph gets introduced and everybody's like, yo, tiny little girl who's like 10, like this is going to be great. And boom, a rock gets lifted off stage and it's like a 7-foot tall, super beefy, buffed up fucking man. And everybody's like, oh, what? And this is where I want to drop my F-bomb. Sokka he's exasperated in this moment and he desperately needs a, oh, fuck off moment. it's there. I can see it in the animation. They just couldn't say it on Nickelodeon. Like I feel it in my heart. And that's where I'd put it. Sokka's just like, man, fuck off.
There's so many bullshit places in the Ember Island Players episode where you could just drop one and it would be so choice.
It would be so good.
I thought you were going to say Toph saying like, fuck yeah.
No, it's too easy, man. Because there's a moment, like there's a pause when Toph's character on stage gets shown and everybody is just like dumbfounded, like incredulous. No, what? No. And Toph is really excited. And like, I feel it in my bones that Sokka wants to say fuck off right there. Like, I feel it.
I'd love it from Sokka or Katara. Katara would be so choice in that.
Yeah, anyway. That would be pretty good too.
What a great question. Thank you, Roland.
Yeah, it's very good.
I love that question. We need to do more of that.
Look, I'm not saying it's going to crop up again and again, but I am saying that.
Okay. All right.
A reoccurring theme in Space Castle, perhaps?
Is that a promise? All right.
Yeah.
Let's go.
A threat.
It depends on your views on a good time.
Seth is going to tell us all to fuck off in the actual podcast instead of just the pregames and afterwards, too. Yeah.
Yep.
It'll be right before I love you.
If I love you, fuck off.
New sign off.
Speaking of sign offs, that's probably going to do it for this episode of Space Castle. As always, it is your clubhouse now is for all things nerdy. I want to thank you guys for listening and implore you to please share us with a friend if you're enjoying what you're hearing. My name is DT. Or is it?
My name is Red Wine and Snatch Alex, part-time librarian, Inverse Batman, Bison Basher, Centaur Biologist, Master and Space Commander. small talk down here.
You know, we actually have our own sort of urban myth going with Alex's titles now. We should devote an episode just to dispelling all those myths. Like, I don't think you're actually a bison basher.
I would defend each one of my titles, thank you.
Here's the thing, DT. I am all about evidence-based conclusions, and I do not need or want the evidence for Molotov Donghammer. And I'm dead Seth. Bye. Love you.